Commence today's show talking politics with Daniel Bogoslaw, investigative reporter for The Intercept. Daniel, how are you today, sir?
I'm doing well. How about yourself?
If I complained, I'd be an ingrate. Even today, I'm doing well, and I'm grateful to be in dialogue with you. Let me jump right in and make the most of this hour that we have. There's a lot to talk about. Let's start with what's happening literally as we speak in this very moment. The judge in the case with Donald Trump, the Stormy Daniels case, the hush money case in New York City brought by Alvin Bragg. The judge, as we speak right now, is hearing arguments about this Trump gag order. And if the judge finds that he violated the gag order, then he is facing a potential, that is, contempt of court. The DA, Alvin Bragg, has asked that Donald Trump be fined, first of all, be found guilty for violating the gag order, then be found, of course, in contempt of court, and then be fined. We had a fascinating dialogue about this yesterday. I have an interesting point of view, I think, and maybe interesting is the wrong word, but I think there are certain things that Donald Trump ought to be allowed to say that ought not violate this gag order. And I think there is a line that Donald Trump, excuse me, has to be weary about crossing. On the one side of the line, if he wants to call this trial a witch hunt, that's his right. And he's running for president. He has a right to be heard. And certainly there's First Amendment considerations. If he wants to call it a witch hunt, that's how he sees it. That's his business. Even if he wants to call it, election interference, I don't buy that argument. But he can make that argument, it seems to me. I'm not the judge, obviously. But there is a line. You can't talk about the judge. You can't talk about his family. You can't threaten jurors. You can't talk about the DA in a certain way, at least, or his family. But again, if the DA is bringing charges against you and you don't like this guy, you think it's bogus, then why can't you say that? So it's a really, really thin line. It's a slippery slope. There are a number of metaphors I could use. But the judge is hearing arguments right now about this Trump gag order. All that said, Daniel, your thoughts?
I would fully agree with you. I think this has been a recurrent question with the president, former president of the United States, in terms of what is the line between incitement and free speech. And I think it's extremely important to, maintain a legal distinction there, because once you remove that barrier, anything that anyone says that you find appalling or disrespectful or egregious, but which is still inside the bounds of free speech, can be immediately discredited. So I think it's critical that people, hold back their, legitimate feelings towards the former president and understand that, we have to look hard and fast at what the actual legal lines are around incitement. And as you said, the distinction you made, targeting a judge's family certainly crosses into incitement, but expressing free speech is a right that's afforded to all Americans, and so I think we do have to be careful about what we label as criminal, terms of speech acts.
Yep, I agree. Even for Donald Trump, we have to be careful about how we label, how we decipher, I should say, this line between incitement and free speech. We'll talk more about that when we come forward. Just getting started in this hour with Daniel Bogoslaw, investigative reporter for The Intercept. There's a great deal to cover, including not just the Trump trial, but the story that was developing yesterday, still developing today, about all these students being arrested on campuses all across the country. They were arrested by the dozens yesterday on the campus of Yale and, for that matter, NYU. They are now doing classes remotely at Columbia after a bunch of arrests there. Harvard announced yesterday they were closing down the famed Harvard Yard. And these students are not just protesting, as Daniel knows, we'll talk about it when we come forward again, but they're now calling for U.S. divestment in arms manufacturers, or in arms, rather, that we supply to Israel. That's an interesting argument. As I was reading more about it last night and this morning and just taking it all in, it reminded me of where we were years ago on South Africa and our divestment there, and how that eventually led to the downfall of the undoing of apartheid in South Africa. These students are not just protesting. They are now linking their protest to the arms that we provide to Israel. And they are calling for a divestment, a backing down of these weapons that we supply to Israel. That changes this conversation dramatically. We'll talk about that. And speaking of Israel, we are now 6 months in, of course, past that mark. And Israel has weakened, I think it's fair to say, but not destroyed, as Bibi said he would, Hamas. They've not yet freed all these hostages. So 6 months in, what frankly has really been accomplished. We'll talk about that and a great deal more with Daniel Bogoslaw when we come forward on Tavis Smiley.
You're listening to Tavis Smiley.
Tavis Smiley.
Ranked number 45 on the Heavy 100 list of the 100 most important radio talk show hosts in America.
Sounds different, huh? This is Tavis Smiley.
This is Tavis Smiley in conversation with Daniel Bogoslaw, who's an investigative reporter for The Intercept, as we commence today's program in this first hour. Daniel, let me come back for a few more minutes, if I can, to this notion of the gag order that the judge is hearing even as we speak, and whether or not Mr. Trump will be found in contempt of court and be fined. I'm concerned about this because, as you put it, we have to be careful. The judge in this case, Judge Marchand, has to be careful about where he comes down on this line between incitement and free speech. And if he gets this wrong, it aids and abets the narrative that Donald Trump has already strung out, that he is being treated unfairly. But once you cross this line into abridging people's right to free speech, that's really dangerous territory for a lot of reasons. But what really concerns me, is, again, the way that this will add to the storyline, the narrative that Donald Trump is already stringing about the way he's being not prosecuted but persecuted by the system. And so I don't know how this judge is going to rule. I don't know where he's going to come down. But it's as I said earlier, I can't find a better metaphor, better word. It is a very slippery slope. And I just wonder, for all of the effort in these indictments, these four different indictments, to get Donald Trump, whether or not, if they play this wrong, they're really playing into his hands. Does that make sense at all to you?
Absolutely. And you know, this has been my criticism of what me and my colleagues call the Trump circus all along, which is that, you know, it's like Lucy in the football. Every time there's a new indictment, you get front page coverage in the New York Times, CNN, MSNBC, Fox. And in the end, we've seen over and over again that no matter how many indictments, no matter how much evidence comes out of wrongdoing, it's keeping the former president in the news. His supporters have made it very clear that there's nothing he can do that can't be excused by him as a mob of liberals attacking him. And the question is this the best use of federal law enforcement's energy and the public writ large energy following every twist and turn of these various civil and criminal cases against the former president, when perhaps a more effective strategy to ensure that he doesn't win re-election would be focusing on, you know, the bread and butter issues that matter to voters, and that could potentially peel off some of those voters who are wavering on the line of seeing these things rack up. Not the vast majority of his base who are unflappable in their support. So again, I think that's definitely a correct read. I think that the damage is already done either way. Whether the charges go through or not, he's gotten earned media. And fortunately, in his case, all publicity is good publicity, and I think it keeps his name in the news. It keeps attention focused on him, which he likes, even though he rails against it. And I think ultimately there's a more efficient way forward for undermining his power.
Let me quote now from Alvin Bragg, the DA in this case, the African-American, the brother DA in Manhattan. The case is not, the core of it is not money for sex. We would say it's about conspiring to corrupt a presidential election and then lying in New York business records to cover it up, close quote. Those are the words of Alvin Bragg. So that's his story. But everybody who's watching this case, every expert tells you that it is not necessarily a slam dunk that Alvin Bragg wins this case. For starters, all Donald Trump needs is one person to say, I'm not buying it. It is money for sex. Trump has denied that he had sex with Stormy Daniels. We'll see what she has to say when she testifies. There were some developments yesterday in this case that make it less likely that Donald Trump, which is his right, will in fact testify, because now the judge rules that they can ask him about E. Jean Carroll and other cases he's lost. So the things that are on the docket that they can ask Donald Trump about has expanded. And that may be a reason why his lawyers refuse to let him take the stand. Of course, you recall the last time somebody tried to tell Donald Trump what he couldn't do, namely on January the 6th. He couldn't go to the Capitol. He jumped in the beast, the presidential car, and tried to force Secret Service to take him to the Hill anyway. So because his lawyers say don't do something, it does not suggest in any way to me that Donald Trump won't do what he's being told not to do. But we'll see in the coming weeks whether or not Donald Trump takes the stand himself. That said, this is not a slam dunk. Work with me, Daniel. So if it's not a slam dunk and all Donald Trump needs is just one person to say, I'm not buying Alvin Bragg's case, it's money for sex and y'all are doing too much here. If Donald Trump wins this case, you talk about the right being emboldened. If he wins this case against or is not found guilty in this case, which is, we are told repeatedly, the weakest of all the four cases, many people argue they shouldn't have brought this case in the first place. And it turns out that this is the case of the four that gets to go first. These other three cases are likely not going to be adjudicated between now and Election Day. So if Donald Trump wins this case, how does that embolden his followers, number one? And then I got a follow-up. Take it from there.
Sure. Well, I think if he wins this case, then he wins his indictment of the criminal justice system. And quite frankly, I think that you have to look at all the players and the incentives here. I mean, there could very well be criminal wrongdoing. At the same time, there's all sorts of incentives, not only for Trump's personal lawyers to say that they represented the former president, but also for the headhunters who are coming from him, who want to nab the biggest game out there on the savannah. And I think the reality is that we live in an unfortunate world where there's a series of very perverse incentives, which are justified often under the rule of law, but in reality often benefit individuals on the left and the right, who are drawn into the maelstrom, the whirlpool of Trump's orbit. And even if they say they're defending democracy or upholding the rule of law, he has developed an incredible power for transforming that aggressive energy directed towards him into a personal asset and a way to boost his profile. So I think you're right. I think it certainly will embolden his supporters even more if he manages to get this tossed. But at the same time, I think the damage is already done and has been done for years now. I think he's proved that, going after him in the court of law is ineffective one way or another. Even when he's forced to pay out millions of dollars in claims, the most effective way is putting forward someone who people respect and listen to even more than him. And unfortunately, I think we've seen time and time again that no amount of indictments, dozens of which have been brought, are able to take him down.
There is no opponent, in a court of law in this country quite like the U.S. government. The resources seem endless. And if and when, which has been the case many times in history, if and when you can beat back the government, when you can beat down the government, and in this case, if you're the first former president to be criminally prosecuted and you can beat back the government, well, you talk about a change in a narrative. I shudder to think what happens to Donald Trump and to his supporters, and they're already energized to begin with. But if they can defeat the government in this case, and again, all they need is one, it's going to be fascinating, for lack of a better word. The flip side of him winning this case is that he is convicted. And if he is convicted, every poll, survey, and study I've read, Daniel, I'm reading the same stuff you're reading. You're probably reading more of it, given that you are an investigative reporter and I'm just a talk show host. But everything I'm reading suggests to me that even amongst his own supporters, if he is convicted, it does drop the level of his support. It does drop the energy, decreases the energy that they have for him. To your point, not much he can do that makes them think that Joe Biden or anybody else is a better candidate, but the numbers are clear that his support does drop if, in fact, he's convicted in any of these cases. And again, this may be the only one that gets to a verdict between now and November. And you combine that with the fact that while he's been winning, he's won all these primary states. Essentially, he's underperformed in these primary states. So that if, in fact, he is convicted in this first of these four cases, that could be a path to victory, strangely, bizarrely, for Joe Biden.
We will see whether that bears out. I find it hard to believe. I think that when you have cultivated your entire political narrative around fighting not only the Department of Justice, but the FBI, the CIA, the so-called deep state, and that has become a fundamental mythos. I think that it's probably very easy for those poll respondents to say right now that their, you know, God Emperor will not be convicted, and therefore to say that if he was convicted, that it would change their opinion of him. But I think if you took that survey a month after he was convicted, they'd say, well, he was convicted on bogus charges. I was only responding about whether he actually had any wrongdoing. So I don't know. I think over the past 8 years, 7 years, we've seen so many accusations, so many indictments, so many charges brought, and it's deja vu all over again to see people making the same argument that this time is going to be different.
Yep. I saw, I didn't get a chance to see the show in real time, but I saw some comments in the news this morning that my friend Jon Stewart made last night on Comedy Central about the way the news media is covering this. And from what I can take, from what I glanced at earlier today, he was chiding them for the way they're covering this. And their his comments were, broadly speaking, that are you guys trying to make this another OJ case? How many times do we have to see Donald Trump walking in and out of the courtroom? How about covering the substantive issues that are just now starting to come out in this case? But to your word, your phrase earlier of a Trump circus, my sense is, when I read that, that's what John was saying last night, that he's been very critical of the way the media is covering this case, the spectacle, as he called it, as I've called it, as others have called it. What's your sense, right quick, Daniel, of the way, at this point at least, the media writ large is covering this trial?
Well, as a reporter, I will say, someone who follows the ebbs and flows of the reporting ecosystem closely, it is undeniable that Trump's victory was extraordinarily good for media companies on both the left and the right. Mm-hmm. Provided an endless stream of coverage. It boosted subscriptions at the New York Times and Washington Post. And after Joe Biden won, they saw a total void where that coverage used to be. So, you know, it is not to cast judgment on whether or not a former president's criminal trial should be covered. Of course it should. But there should be similar amounts of coverage dedicated to the potential staff appointees that are going to fill a second Trump administration. There should be coverage to the social policies and programs that will either be slashed and decimated under him or you know, kept at the same meager levels under his challenger. And the notion that extreme coverage of this trial is more effective than that at educating voters, I think, is laughable.
Yeah, I think what Daniel just said is that that Joe Biden may be good for the country, if you believe that. Many of us do, that he certainly is far better than Donald Trump. He may be good for the country, but he ain't good for likes, clicks, and downloads. Donald Trump wins that argument. He's much better for likes, clicks, and downloads, while Biden may be better for the country. We shall see what happens in the coming days. But this trial is about to get interesting because as we see more and more what Alvin Bragg has to say, trying to make this argument that it's not just a hush money case, it's not just a money for sex case, but something much deeper. We will see if the jury buys that argument. I repeat once again, as you well know, he only needs one, that is to say, Mr. Trump only needs one person to not see it the way Alvin Bragg sees it, and he effectively wins this case. I can't imagine under any conditions that they would retry this thing, so it's going to be one and done, whatever the outcome is going to be. That's my sense of it. Our guest is Daniel Bogislaw, investigative reporter for The Intercept. When we come forward, again, a great deal more to cover now. We've covered Trump, at least that's enough for me for now, 30 minutes of that. There's other stuff to cover, though. Let's talk about these students. This story is getting more and more interesting, more and more fascinating for me. These students who are not letting up on campuses all across the country, the protests are raging. And as these students get arrested, and trust me, I'm thinking of Dr. King and all these young folk that got arrested then, and the babies in Birmingham, literally our children who were let out of school and were put in harm's way and were willing to be put in harm's way for the sake of civil rights. These students are allowing themselves to be arrested and detained and jailed, and their parents have to bail them out. That's how strongly they feel about this issue at Yale and at NYU and at Harvard and at Columbia and all around. These students are having their say, but this argument that they're making now that they want something done about this cozy arms relationship, this arms deal, where we supply all these weapons to Israel to do the damage that's been done. That part of the story is what I want to talk about. And as I said earlier, we're now past the six-month mark, and they have not, Israel has not destroyed Hamas. They have not gotten all those hostages freed. So there's a big question to be asked about what, in fact, has been accomplished 6 months in. That and more with Daniel Bogoslaw when we come forward on Tavis Smiley.
Seeking the truth. Speaking the truth. This is the Tavis Smiley Show. Ready to re-examine your assumptions and expand your inventory of ideas? More of Tavis Smiley coming your way right now.
More of Tavis Smiley and Daniel Bogoslaw coming your way right now. He is the investigative reporter for The Intercept, and I'm pleased to have him on. Before I get to these students and some other issues, Daniel, I've been reading your writing and your reporting about Washington's handling of the Iran-Israel conflict. I don't need to color it much more than that. Tell me what you've learned in that regard.
Well, I think really what we've learned is that there has been a conflict bubbling under the surface that global watchers are really seeing exposed for the first time before it quiets down. We're seeing a dramatic shift, though, in the network of relationships surrounding Israel and Iran. You know, whether it was the Trump administration or the Biden administration, normalization of Gulf states like Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates with Israel has been the championed policy for ratcheting down tensions in that region. And what this attack really showed was that those relationships, which have been heralded by both administrations, are much more fragile than we've been led to believe. Iran basically threatened Saudi and UAE and said, if you get involved in this mess, you know, you're going to be added to our enemies list. And, you know, basically overnight, we saw those countries which were once steadfast supporters of both the United States and Israel to a large extent basically back away and calm down. So I think, you know, again, we're really seeing the full shakiness of a Middle East, which pundits and politicians have said is being stabilized, start to break down overnight.
Yeah. We know full well the history of protest in this country, and for that matter, around the globe. And we know the power that resides in protest when people are committed to their cause. I mentioned earlier the protest in this country years ago that helped to defeat apartheid in South Africa. I mentioned moments ago the civil rights movement and the students and the babies in Birmingham and beyond who took to the streets when the nation saw the dogs being sicked on these babies and the water hoses, fire hoses being turned against them and cops with billy clubs beating young people. When the nation saw that, these protests made a difference, obviously. And I'm starting to feel that way now about these student protests across the country regarding Gaza. I'm looking at a story right now that students are setting up Gaza solidarity camps, calling for a divestment from Israel all across the country. And so it's not just Yale and Harvard and Columbia, but it's also Barnard, it's Vanderbilt, all across the country. I could call the names of colleges from California to the Carolinas, where, again, they are now setting up what they are calling Gaza solidarity camps, but more to the point, calling for divestment from Israel. I've said this on this program before. I think that we are living in a different age. It's a different era. And this conversation about the U.S.'s relationship to Israel and all the financial support that we have provided to Israel, that conversation has come under a different lens. There's a different scrutiny now about that conversation, even inside the White House. You saw the stories weeks ago, Daniel, that there are folks inside the White House on the staff who've expressed their concerns to the president about this particular issue. So what I want to talk about specifically are two parts. I'll let you take it from here. One is what you make of these student protests. And secondly, what do you make of the dynamic and organic conversation specifically that's jumped off now about divestment from Israel?
Well, to start with divestment, I mean, I think this is students, you know, taking an issue that's close to them and using it to amplify their messaging. I think the Biden administration has been extremely concerned about the youth vote. People are not energized for Biden. They don't think that he's responding to their concerns and their priorities as young people. And I think attaching a movement to the universities, you know, gives students a way to not just protest the U.S. government, but sort of amplify their concerns through the university system, which they're a part of, calling not only for the universities to divest, but also for the United States to, you know, at the very least, create conditions for arms sales. You know, while students are suffering under tens of thousands of dollars of student debt and are watching the promises of you know, millennials and boomer generations, you know, having a house, having a car, not struggling under debt until the grave, pass them by, you know, they're saying, why is the U.S. government continuing to cash, you know, $10 billion checks to the Israeli military when we can't even provide basic social services here at home? Now, in terms of similarities to past protest movements, I think this is where it gets really interesting. Mm-hmm. And something I've written about a lot is the way that we see a sort of McCarthyite language being dredged up from the ashes of the Vietnam era by those same three-letter agencies that we know were involved in monitoring anti-Vietnam protesters, which we know were involved in manipulating MLK. You know, the FBI's Hoover era is back in full force, whether it's the director of the National Counterterrorism Center saying that the threat posed by Hamas is justification to renew warrantless mass surveillance of Americans, or whether it's FBI Director Christopher Wray saying that, you know, Hamas poses a new, unique homeland security challenge. And we see that rhetoric coming from the highest levels of U.S. national security community being regurgitated by pundits and redirected at college students, some of whom are Jewish, whether it's at Columbia, whether it's at Brown, whether it's at Vanderbilt, who are, you know, protesting and exercising their free speech, calling on the U.S. government to stop funding a war that they find to be unjust. And the response, whether it's from the national security community, politicians or pundits, is to label them as domestic terrorists. And I think, you know, just as we were talking about with Donald Trump and labeling his speech as violence when it's not legally when there's no legal precedent for that, it's extremely dangerous to label peaceful protesters as terrorists. And I think, you know, one difference we're seeing between Vietnam, although not a huge difference, is the connection to Hamas, you know, a recognized terrorist organization. But again, the vast majority of these protests are not pro-Hamas. They're calling for very specific monetary changes, whether that's deinvestment of their universities or whether it's a larger national deinvestment from the Israeli military and persistent U.S. Arm transfers. But just to reiterate that point, I do think that the Vietnam civil rights era comparison is apt, especially when you look at the response from national security agencies, which are clearly eager to insert themselves into these protests.
Let me go out on a limb here. We'll talk to Daniel Bogoslaw about this more when we come forward in just a moment. But let me step out on this branch and say to you right now that my prediction, which really ain't that bold, if you know history, my prediction is that when we get to Chicago this summer, and I'll be there live, for the Democratic National Convention, the storyline is not going to be Joe Biden and the nomination. It would not be Kamala Harris. The storyline is going to be all these protests outside of the United Center. That's going to be the story. The story is not going to be what happens on the inside. It's going to be the coverage of all that's happening on the outside. And in that way, 2024 is shaping up to be so much more like 1968 than I even thought just a few weeks ago. But if these student protests on these campuses across the country continue to grow, and I suspect they will, because the more you arrest, the more committed they're going to become. They understand the storyline that they're helping to write here. So my prediction is that 1968 is going to be repeated in 2024 on steroids. We'll talk about that part when we come forward on Tavis Smiley.
Hope, agency, dignity. This is Tavis Smiley.
Can you dig it?
Come on!
Who do you trust to get at the truth?
Tavis Smiley.
Smiley.
That's who. The conversation continues right now.
So, Daniel, you think I'm right or wrong about what's going to happen in Chicago this summer?
Well, the historical parallels are definitely all lined up. And I think that, you know, if the interruptions at various Biden campaign events are anything to go by, then, you know, the momentum doesn't seem to be slowing down. But I think that in order to really build to that crescendo, I think that protesters need to do the same thing that was happening during Vietnam. I think the single most effective tool that protesters have for getting mass buy-in from all types of Americans is, you know, connecting this back to day-to-day struggles. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, when people all over the world see images of U.S. bombs decapitating children, when they see pictures of U.S.-funded soldiers lining up people in their underwear blindfolded, you know, this puts Americans at risk in America. Mm-hmm. It delegitimizes our standing around the world in Latin America, in East Asia. And in fact, we've even seen attacks and deaths of U.S. soldiers, U.S. military personnel, some of them, you know, National Guards men from the Deep South, you know, serving on bases in Jordan, who are targeted based on the U.S. support for this war in Gaza. And so I think, you know, this has to be not just a sort of left-wing third worldist movement, but yeah. I think if protesters really are going to crescendo in Chicago, they need to make the argument that this affects all Americans, whether it's literally putting their lives on the line and risking increased attacks, or whether it's stripping away tens of billions of dollars from the types of social programs, schools, hospitals, police, the basic infrastructure of a society, yeah. This affects everyone. And I think that's going to be the message that resonates in Chicago if they can make it to it.
Let me ask you right quick, before we come forward here, whether or not you think there is or see, a better way to put it, any appetite at the moment in Congress for a U.S.-Israel divestment conversation.
I think the bottom line is a simple one when it comes to Congress, which is that the Israel lobby, AIPAC, is the most powerful lobby in America. And until the tides of hard cash shift away from AIPAC, I don't think that Congress is going to change just because money in politics works. And yeah. Right now, AIPAC is cashing the biggest checks.
Our remaining moments with Daniel Boguslaw of The Intercept when we come forward on Tavis Smiley.
What's your quarrel with the world? You're listening to Tavis Smiley. Smart talk for curious people just like you. Just like you. You're listening to Tavis Smiley.
Tavis Smiley and Daniel Boguslaw of The Intercept. So, Daniel, you've been writing about this, you and your team at The Intercept, for all 6 months of this war campaign inside of Gaza, inside of Palestine. Your sense of what, in fact, has been accomplished in these 6 months. As I said earlier, it's hard to argue that Hamas has not been weakened, but that ain't what Bibi Netanyahu said he was going to do. That was not the goal. They said they were going to destroy, abolish, wipe out Hamas. That ain't happening, as I said 6 months ago. And secondly, off the top of my head, you know, there are a long list of these issues I could point to, but they've not been successful even in freeing all the hostages. So I ask, to your mind, and given what The Intercept has been covering, what has in fact been accomplished in the last 6 months?
Well, I think first and foremost, what's been accomplished is that Netanyahu has remained in power. He's been able to use this war and its prolongation to maintain control and try to navigate under his own trial, which he's been very fortunate to have this conflict under him as a distraction for. I think his escalations with Iran have further prolonged the destability of his country. And, you know, I think the main accomplishment is that he's still in power. There's no metric to determine how many Hamas inspired fighters have been created through the distribution of images and videos of alleged war crimes and brutality in the Gaza Strip. So there's no way to even measure whether Hamas has been reduced or strengthened based on the fact that we don't have a measurement or a metric of the people who are inspired. And meanwhile, the United States just authorized more military funding, even though it's unclear that, despite Biden's direct statements to Netanyahu to wrap things up, there's any intention of doing so. Meanwhile, Israel has lost national standing on the global stage and has effectively created a massive thorn in Biden's side for his 2024 reelection chances. So in terms of hard gains against the enemy in Israel, I think there's little to point to. But in terms of global and domestic disruption, I think there's plenty to go around.
Yeah, I think a thorn in Biden's side is a charitable and generous read of what this has done. We shall see, Daniel, but that's charitable and generous as far as I'm concerned. I close on this note, and I'm glad you raised it. I don't know that we, and by we I mean all of us, all Americans, I don't know that we give much consideration to the brilliant point you made a moment ago. When you kill 30,000 plus people, unless you're stuck on stupid, you have to know that you are inspiring thousands more people. You can't kill 30 plus thousand people not think that their loved ones and that others are not going to be inspired by that. So in many respects, it's yeah, I don't even want to say it on the radio, but you take my point. It's something we don't talk about, but it just means that this thing is unending.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I'll leave it there. His name is Daniel Bogoslaw. He is the investigative reporter for The Intercept, and I have been delighted to have him on this program to discuss all the breaking news of this day. Again, we shall see a little bit later what the judge decides in the Trump gag order, and of course we'll continue to follow issues in the Middle East as they warrant. Daniel, good to have you on the program, my friend. All the best to you, sir.
All right, thanks for having me.
Good to have you on. Two great hours in front of us. You're listening, and I'm glad about it, to Tavis Smiley.